WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The painter Larry Rivers died last week of liver cancer. He was 78. We waited until today for our remembrance so that we could devote more time to it. As Carrie Rickey put it, Rivers wedded representation with abstraction, parodied art history, anticipated by a decade the concerns of both the pop and color field painters, and prophetically engaged in what postmodernists might call appropriation and deconstruction. New York Times art critic Michael Kimmelman wrote, "Rivers helped change the course of American art in the 50s and 60s, but his virtues as an artist always seemed inextricably bound up with his vices, the combination producing work that could be by turns exhilarating and appalling. He had an omnivorous curiosity about life, sex, drugs, politics, history, and culture." Larry Rivers' good friend, the late poet Frank O'Hara, summed up Rivers this way, "Larry entered the scene like a demented telephone. Nobody knew whether to put it in the library, the kitchen, or the toilet, but it was electric." I spoke with Larry Rivers in 1992.
Now, often when you paint a figure, there's a feature that's missing, you know, there's one eye, but the other eye is kind of blank. It hasn't been painted at all.
Yes.
How did you start doing that?
Well, I think there was a certain spontaneity in my work. In other words, if no matter what I was doing, I wanted it to come off sort of quickly or without too much trouble. And, you know, as yet I hadn't run to the point where I wanted things to look labored and that I really did a lot of hard work, which would be a reflection of a certain kind of good character. So the first eye, you don't have to worry about where you're placing. I mean, you just put it down somewhere below a brow or something like that. But when you come to the second eye, you really have to make calculations about how wide they're apart. There's no way of putting in a second eye unless you're Picasso to make them realistic without sort of real close judgment and changes and things that would slow you down, would make your hand work, let's say, from the knuckles instead of an arm movement. And I think that I just left it out at first. For those reasons, I didn't think it was necessary, really, what it amounted to. And I think there are other parts of the body missing, too, but people notice it in the face because the face is so clearly an image that we know all the parts of.
Something else you've done throughout most of your career is write on paintings. Sometimes the letters are stenciled, sometimes handwritten.
Yeah.
Sometimes parts of letters are missing or blurred. How did you start using words on paintings?
Well, I think that, don't forget the Cubists had the word journal. I mean, they would have a newspaper in their painting. So in other words, I didn't do anything that was that, new. The only thing is, I think I was bolder about it and didn't hide it in a certain way. And it also, in certain paintings, it's almost the point of the painting. I did these vocabulary lessons, which obviously are words and features. And I thought that I thought there was something sort of ironic, I suppose, in all that. And please forgive me for trying to be ironic, but that was one of the reasons. Also, my hand is a very artistic one in the sense that I make gestures with my paint, and they're like loose flowing and things like that. Whereas a letter has sharp edges and it's very much more definite than the painting. So the combination of this very definite thing plus this loose, arty kind of work with colors all over the place seemed to make me happy.
You married when you were pretty young.
Yes.
Your girlfriend got pregnant and that's right. How you ended up getting married. She already had a son.
Right.
But you didn't want a family. In fact, you wrote, "My life was not going to be about living, it was going to be about art."
Right.
So you felt pretty trapped by having a family.
I guess so. I given my personality, I probably didn't even feel trapped. I nothing was going to stop me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've felt a little bit something. Don't forget, I never really gave them up, and eventually I really brought them up. I brought up these boys and lived with the woman's mother. I lived with my wife's mother. I didn't live with the wife. So it's complicated looking it over. I mean, I was not going to be stopped from what I wanted to do, but at the same time, I wasn't going to abandon the boys or, the mother. And we lived together, and they were very helpful in many ways.
Do you think that you couldn't have become an artist without being somewhat selfish?
That's right. I think I modeled myself on my distorted notion of what Picasso was about. I thought that somewhere along the line I had heard that, without reading it somewhere, that Picasso, you know, walked away from every relationship and children and things like that, and all that life was about was art. And I felt that that model was something that it was of interest to me.
Looking back, do you think that you behaved badly toward your family?
Some people might. I don't think I behaved badly. I made up, in one way, I was sort of, you know, on my own, selfish, things like that, but at the same time, I provided for them. And so it's not very different than what most men are about. They go to offices 8-10 hours a day, and they come back and don't bother me. They're looking at television or a newspaper, they're drinking a beer or whatever it is, and then the child walks in, they give them a 2-minute kiss, and maybe once a year they go somewhere for 3 weeks or something. I don't think life is that different, you know, among for myself and other people.
We're listening back to a 1992 interview with the painter Larry Rivers. He died last week of liver cancer. He was 78. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. The painter Larry Rivers died last week at the age of 78. He had liver cancer. Let's get back to the interview we recorded in 1992.
Now, your mother-in-law, who you lived with for many years, you painted her naked a couple of times.
Yes.
And I'll just describe her physically briefly. She's you know, an older woman, kind of heavy, an almost what we describe as peasant-like body.
Okay.
Is it fair?
I never heard that expression about her body.
Go ahead.
But anyway, you mean the painting that's in the Whitney Museum? It's Birdie Twice?
Birdie Twice, yeah. Why did you want, you know, it seems like a real taboo, don't you think, to paint your mother-in-law naked?
Well, I told my mother-in-law, if you read the book, that part, I said to Birdie, she sort of said, "Why do you want to paint me?" You know, she had the simple notion that an artist wants to paint beautiful things. She looked at herself, she didn't think she was beautiful. So I said, Rembrandt painted older women, I forget her name. Anyway, she's got her 2 feet in a stream, and she has a kind of a gown raised up, and she's not a young woman. Now, you didn't see a breast, but there are others that Rembrandt did where you do see this older woman. I thought that I had a very special opportunity. I was able to get someone that age, close to me, who actually I could really look at and see what was going on. So it had 2 levels. I painted it to make a painting and things like that, but I couldn't help be aware of what, you know, happens to the body. I was actually amazed that it looked that good. What I mean, I'm talking about on a sexual level. She didn't really seem to me to be unattractive.
Were you uncomfortable, or was she uncomfortable when she was posing for you?
I certainly wasn't uncomfortable. I felt that she maybe the first few times, and she sort of, it was okay. It was a son-in-law, you know, she thought that anything she could do to help. Mm-hmm. I told her, you know, that maybe we'll sell that painting, something. So she actually thought she was posing for the good reason, a working-class woman who thought that, you know, we would make some money or something like that. And
did you?
Did I? I think when I sold those paintings, they weren't very expensive and things like that. I made something, sure. But I wish I had a lot of them today. I would have made more.
Now, you also did a naked painting of your son, Joe,
yep,
when he was 14. And
right,
there's a part in your book where he talks about what it was like,
yes,
to be painted by you. And he wrote that he wanted to be immortalized in your paintings, but he didn't really want to hang around and pose nude for it. He was 14 at the time.
Right.
In the painting, he's nude except for his socks. He
right,
says his pubic hair was just coming in.
Right.
And then the portrait was shown at the Southampton Gallery in Long Island, New York, and half of the high school from that area had their parental permission to go to the gallery.
Right.
And he was very embarrassed.
In other words, walk into that gallery, they'd have a note from their parents that they could walk into that gallery. Go ahead.
And then finally the police removed the painting,
right,
of your son, and he
right,
was relieved. And he says to this day he has a twinge of embarrassment when he sees it.
Yeah.
Did you realize he was going to feel that way, that, you know, at the age of 14
no,
it was going to be
no,
kind of embarrassing?
It was all very jolly, like I suppose a lot of families in which, you know, you don't, there's a central pot everybody's dipping into, and that's the sort of the ones that don't speak of the dark things. I think that he may have felt that way, but maybe I even thought about it, but I didn't think it was anything to it's anything too much to ask of a child, truthfully speaking. And I think he actually, you know, he did. He knew he was a painter, and that's what I do, and that he would be useful. If he was embarrassed, I'm sorry. You know, so what?
So how did you feel when the police took the nude portrait of your son away?
I wasn't surprised, actually. I thought, you know, it's the United States of America, and that's what they do. And I thought it was following a certain pattern. I actually got a boot out of it. Like, in other words, when do you start hearing of people? Only when they do something sort of like Maple. No one heard of Mapplethorpe until those things were shown, and everybody got into the act about how horrible and pornographic and, you know, base it was and things like that. So I probably thought I was following a certain, you know, path of the avant-garde. Like, you do a painting, there's a lot of clamor, take it down, and then it ends up in history books. When that was first painted, thousands of people protested. Now look, it's a masterpiece. I must have thought all that.
So you thought maybe it was a good career move?
Well, not exactly career move, but you mean that they took it down?
That they took it down, yeah.
Maybe. I didn't think exactly that way, but it got a lot of attention because of it.
You were very close with the poet Frank O'Hara.
You were
lovers for a while, even
yes.
though you don't think of yourself as homosexual and have, you know,
right.
been married twice.
I was so straight I could be homosexual.
But you write that you started thinking of yourself for the first time as sexually attractive
yeah.
when you started hanging out in homosexual circles.
Right.
How did that affect you?
How did it affect me? Well, I just said it. To feel sexually attractive is rather pleasant. But I think that I didn't get that. I'm not saying that that's why I got interested in men, but that there was that difference in my existence, that women didn't talk about, you know, some guy with a great ass or, you know, a great basket, as the homosexual talk at that time. And the area around the fly as it's telling you what's going on inside it. But it was sort of interesting. I mean, it brought me up to another level about sex, that I too could be, exciting to someone, is really what it amounted to. Now, I really wanted it to be with women. They would go to bed with you, but I never got the feeling that it was... that they went to bed with you because you were sexually exciting. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of silly. I feel now like a baby. I can't see how they could have not thought that. Why would they go to bed with me? They wanted to have sex with me. But I never interpreted it that way.
When you were younger, you were part of a circle of artists, musicians, poets. And, I mean, there were even, like, artist bars to hang out in. Is there anything in your life like that now?
No. I have a band, but there's no place. You have personal friends. And I don't go to bars. It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing because people know you? Or
no, not because people know me. It's that I thought bars were a place to go to try to pick up someone. Forgive me. And to the idea of sitting there with this notion in my mind, looking the way I do, and getting the treatment of Mr. Rivers, you know, where you're no longer a possibility for a liaison, but just respected citizen of Southampton or wherever you are, or they don't even know. It's just, it's too obvious. And I think that it just doesn't work anymore.
Okay.
So I stay home and paint.
Larry Rivers, recorded in 1992 after the publication of his memoir. He died last week at the age of 78. He had liver cancer. The Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. has extended its retrospective of Rivers' work until August 25th.